Water is absolutely crucial for any farm. Many Breton places have water, but it's concentrated in very short rainy seasons, leading to massive erosion and long dry periods. So identifying yeoman's key points and key lines on or off contour, and thus altering the behavior of water, has proved to be very successful around the world in regenerating soils and farms. It has been traditionally done by walking the land. What if we could teach an algorithm to do it potentially even more accurately? That would open up landscape-scale design of water systems and where to plant trees, graze animals, etc., etc. Tempering climate change, bringing back rivers, preventing floods, and obviously lots and lots of nutrient-dense food. The promises of Regen Ag often sounds straight out of a science fiction book. And for these promises to be met, we need to significantly scale regeneration to a landscape scale within this decade. Welcome to a new series where we look into the technologies needed to bring regeneration to a landscape scale. In this series, we'll look at already existing technologies, digital tech, ag tech, new financing mechanisms, etc., that can scale fast enough during the next 10 years. Technologies which put significantly more money into the pockets of farmers, landowners, and land stewards who are regenerating their and our soils so they can go faster. And we'll ask the question, what is missing? What needs to be urgently developed over the next years? We're very happy with the support for this series by the Grantham Environmental Trust, which supports strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems. You can find out more at granthamfoundation.org. In March last year, we launched our membership community, make it easy for fans to support our work, and so many of you have joined as a member. We've launched different types of benefits, exclusive content, Q&A webinars with former guests, Ask Me Anything sessions, plus so much more to come in the future. For more information on the different tiers, benefits, and how to become a member, check gumroad.com/investingregenag or find the link below. Thank you. Welcome to another episode. Today, I want to start with reading a small piece of an article that caught my attention and why I reached out to Jason to record this interview. For the first time in Nigeria, marking an important milestone in the booming regenerative agriculture sector, Regen Farm has used satellite data to produce an artificial intelligence-generated design, plotting a regenerative agroforestry system. Using yeoman's key point and key line principles on a landscape scale, designing including cultivation lines on contour, multi-species tree planting and water storage infrastructure was produced in the UK for use in Nigeria. The AI-generated design was found to be accurate within 0.1 meters, and the groundwork will begin shortly to turn the design into reality. This obviously piqued my interest, and I reached out to Jason, who agreed to come on the show and talk about this and a lot more. So welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Corin. It's great to be here.
I think it's the first time, or one of the first times I saw the words yeoman, key point, and key line used in the same sentence as artificial intelligence. So we're going to unpack that. But first, I want to hear a bit more about you and how you came to work on soil, in soil, and especially on water, obviously. Like, what led you to doing this regenerative work?
Sure, I've been in farming all my teenage and adult life. Farming was a lot different back when I was younger, but something clicked, I think, when I first stepped onto a farm. I kind of loved the environment, was embraced by it, and I thought, well, this is what I want to do. And then led me to becoming involved in farm management and farm consultancy, not just in the UK, but around the world. And the sustainability of food production was very interesting to me. I studied at Agricultural College in the UK, where that wasn't a big component of what we did. We were taught how to drive big tractors and spray chemicals and all this, put fertilizer everywhere. And I left that becoming a bit disillusioned, but determined that there is another way. And so working in different cultures and locations around the world, I learned a lot from the way farming is traditionally done. And then that sort of led me down the path of sustainable agriculture and permaculture. And I found myself in Australia. Married an Australian girl, and kids were born in Australia. But that's where the permaculture movement started, with Bill Mollison and David Holgram, and that really fascinated me. And 15 years ago, we were kind of sitting around campfires singing about permaculture, and then this term regenerative agriculture came in. But now, instead of sitting around campfires, we're sitting in boardrooms talking about it. So it's come a long way, and it's fascinating how it's come out of the shadows, really, and people are grasping it. It's a big term, regenerative agriculture, and people first, what is it? How do we unpack it? But, you know, it can be described in several ways, but it's definitely something that's very important personally in my life to pursue this and becoming interesting from a business angle for family farmers, commercial farmers. So it's a great journey to be on.
And coming out of that ag school where it was about big tractors and a lot of spraying, and you mentioned you knew there was another way or there was a different way. How did you knew that? Was there one lesson that piqued any interest? Did you visit one of the leading organic farms or one of the pioneers? Or how did you know? Because there was no YouTube, there were very little books, there was no permaculture design course, I'm imagining, in the UK yet, or maybe there was, but it was in the shadows. Like, how did you know and didn't just join a big tractor operating farm somewhere?
There was this one, I think about half an hour's worth of a lecture that started discussing organic production without the use of artificial things. And that's all we had to... that little hook to grab hold of.
Which turned your career around, basically. Changed your whole path.
Yeah, it did. But of course, back then it was very slow and people were very skeptical, which, you know, a lot of people still are. But thankfully, that whole scene has got bigger and more professional and more accepted. And now that side of things is growing quickly, as opposed to that conventional way of doing things is under pressure. So I think we're going down the right route, finally. But there's a long way to go still.
There is. No, we're in the first innings or in the first minutes of a very long match or whatever sport we're playing. And how did that lead from singing around the campfire about permaculture to working on technology to scale many of the key principles, which are around water, which we'll start to unpack? Like, that seems a big step, because many of the permaculture designs I've seen and I've interacted with are relatively small scale because they're very human focused, which is very good because you need to interact closely with the landscape and read it. And there are only very few people that are able to do that. But that hence, that's usually a relatively small farm, even could be a huge one in Australia, but still on the grand scheme of things, it's quite small. So where did that, from singing the campfire to programming these kind of complicated algorithms, how did that go?
Sure. Well, I was at the time, and I still do have a consulting business, just helping farmers improve their business performance. And that involves me at some point walking around the fields and measuring things and with a tape measure or a spirit level or something like that. And
when you say measure things, what is that?
Well, you know, for designing, you know, for let's have something here. It was a very practical way of doing things, hands-on, face-to-face. And fantastic, and I enjoy that still. But my idea was, if we were to open up regenerative agriculture to be more accessible to many more farmers, it's going to require millions of me to do this. And so we need to be able to scale out with some kind of technology. And so the idea for Regen Farm was to develop... this was my initial thought, to develop a digital version of myself. And so some way I can interact not just with, say, 20 farmers a year, but 2,000 or 20,000. And that was at that stage, that was as far as my technological knowledge went. So I said, well, I have this basic idea of what we want to do. And I went to the Impact Lab, Environmental Impact Lab at Exeter University Science Park. And it was their opening day. And I rocked up there with a kind of one pager and said, look, I've got this idea. And I talked to the people there from the Impact Lab and from Rothamsted Research. And they said, well, this looks interesting. And let's develop a prototype to see where this might go. And so they did. And we field tested that with a number of local farmers. And it got a little bit of traction, a little bit of interest. You could see this little click in people's minds saying, oh, hold on a second. This is useful. This is a way we can use a kind of a simulation software to help those farmers who are nervous or reluctant to change their production methods and go down a different pathway. This could possibly be a good tool for them. And it all started there, really. But I quickly realized that that was the limit of my technological knowledge. And so I had to involve other people for coding development, algorithm development. And that was the real interesting bit for myself in these early stages. It's how do you take this high-tech coding algorithm sector and merge it with the agricultural industry, which is at some point archaic, like this, I described it as a lumbering dinosaur that's just lurching forward. And how do we join those two worlds together and make some improvements? And again, that was kind of just a very loose description of the ideas I had, but involving other people, algorithm development experts, other technology people, helped us shape something that would be very usable by farmers and by different sectors to help all of those stakeholders take a few more steps down that regenerative agriculture path. So that was kind of the early stages of it. That was about 3 years ago now. And things have really come along well and gone off in different directions that I never thought we'd be going down. But it's just wonderful.
And that first steps, were you already working on or going after the water side of things on a landscape level or on the farm level? Was that your entry point saying, okay, if there's one thing that technology could help and helping these farmers that want to make a few more steps or want to make the first few steps, we have to start with water? Or if you look at the scale of permanence, it's one of those first steps. Like, why did you choose for the water side of things and not, I don't know, using AI technology to help better compost facilities or a better local biofertilizer or something like that?
A wise man once told me that there are only 8 ingredients to any food production system anywhere on Earth. And they are, he explained to me, in order of magnitude, I guess, sun and air, soil, water, plants, animals, people and money. And if you mix all those together in different ways, you have an agricultural food production industry. So the first two, sun and air, it's hard to manipulate those, like kind of it is what it is, so let's leave those. But the next two, soil and water, if you can improve those things on a farm, make them better, have them work with you, then you're setting yourself up for success. So working with the soil and water was very appealing, and it took us back a few steps. Then we started to think about, okay, how do we understand how soil and water behaves on a landscape? How do we capture that information, and how do we use that to help us redesign how a farm works using these principles that were first developed by P.A. Yeomans back in the 50s in Australia. He works in very brittle landscapes, very dry landscapes where water
is crucial.
Right? Absolutely, yeah. King. If you don't have it.
So what are the principles for anybody? I mean, we know Yeomans also from a plow, which is not really a plow, but like there's technology came out of that ecosystem as well. But what are the principles for anybody that hasn't done those deep dives?
So very simply, when he talks about water and about key points and key lines, if you can identify in a landscape where the water changes behavior, where that convex landscape going down the hill turns into a concave landscape, at that key point is the point at which water begins to behave differently, becomes less erosive and more able to deposit things. And at that point, you're able to passively manipulate its behavior by taking it sideways along contours and rehydrate the landscape. So I thought, well, if we can have a technological tool.
Because you used to do this by hand, you used to walk the land.
Yeah.
A lot of people do that, and it's very, I've seen it happen. It's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do by eye as well, because its landscapes always seem different than they actually are. Like water behaves, it seems to run uphill in some cases, but it's not obviously, but it seems our eyes are good at it, but not very good. And so you need to train a lot to be able to walk the contours properly and then to do it. But it's such an essential job that we've done. If you look at most landscapes, I'm looking at a hilly landscape here right in front of me. We haven't. Like, we just planted even up the hill. If you see most landscapes, when it rains or when water comes, it's absolutely not capturing it to the fullest, to use an understatement. But so you used to do that by hand and by eye and with some very rudimental tools. And you said, no, let's bring that to the technology space where there are no human eyes that can make interesting errors.
Exactly. You, in order to be able to do it by eye, you have to be this sort of landscape whisperer that you know, knows how it works. And I'm not that, that's for sure. So, and I can get it to within about 5 meters or something like that. But it has to be more accurate, I think, to get the most from it. So we employed some data acquisition and ran a lot of data through some test algorithms to define not only where that key point would be, but also how we could do different channels along contour or just off contour. And it really taught us how the power of artificial intelligence in large landscape designs is really useful. Now, if we had a couple of acres and, you know, we can go around and, oh, it's about there and that's fine. But the landscapes we're working on are hundreds of thousands of hectares. So for me to walk around with a tape measure and a spirit level, it just wouldn't happen.
So even if you had 100 of Jasons, or even, I don't even know what would be the number of people in the world that are, let's say, landscape whisperers. They're very much, obviously, they're always busy because they have an endless amount of clients. But even them all put together probably couldn't easily do 100,000 acres or hectares like that. And we need to do like 2 billion hectares that are degraded. So it's just the math just simply doesn't work, even if we 10x it or 100x the amount of people that are good at this.
And the speed with which you can do it as well. So we designed this system, which for one of our clients in Nigeria, we'll speak about that.
Yeah, let's talk about the project. Just describe, this is in, if I understood well, northern Nigeria, just describe the landscape, because we are in an audio podcast, just to, for us to feel, if we won't walk around there, what would we see, what would we touch, what would we feel and smell?
Sure. Northern Nigeria, based around the city of Kano, very flat, very arid, and the water comes in large amounts during the rainy season and then drains away. The soil is very low in organic matter, so it's kind of boom and bust territory, massive amounts of erosion.
So even when it's very flat, this kind of water work is possible and essential. Asking a very stupid question, probably, but yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's easy to see in a mountainous landscape or hilly landscape how water behaves, but if you get flatter, those undulations are far more subtle and nuanced, and you can't sometimes see them with the naked eye, but you can see the results of it with big channels being cut, big erosion taking place. So to have something that measures the water movement in centimeter differences, and it starts there, right? So a river channel starts to erode a bit every year, and all of a sudden you've got something as deep as, you know, several meters, and your topsoil is gone. So that landscape lends itself to accuracy, high resolution data. And so what we did was, for the first test plot, we thought, well, let's go for it. Let's do a 10,000 hectare plot and see what we can go.
Let's start small.
Let's start small and manageable, of course. And everybody, all the tech guys just groaning at me going, oh, God. But no, let's go for it. And this was on our client's land, Tajuddin Dantata's land, his personal land and the community that surrounded it. So it's not a random place. It's actually something we'll be working on in the future with this design. So we continued to develop the algorithm and inserted sort of additions like agroforestry lines and water channels, water storage areas. Where would be the best places for these to be sited on the landscape? Just to come up with a big design as a starting point.
And the data you use was satellite plus others, or what's the input data you need to get to that accuracy?
Yeah, it was satellite data down to about 1 meter resolution. The free stuff, the Sentinel data, EU satellites, is 25 meter resolution. So to look at those subtle differences on a flat landscape, it wasn't enough. It's like looking through the landscape through a blurred set of glasses and you couldn't see it. So it was expensive to buy the data, but we bought it and pushed it through the algorithms and they gave this design. And then I was in Nigeria a few months ago and the team says, okay, we think we've got it. Can you go around and ground truth it and see what's what? So they gave me a few test areas to do this. And the day we went, it was during Ramadan, so nobody's drinking any water. It was 45 degrees and we must have walked for several hours just ground truthing this thing. It was a very difficult day, but by the end of it we all kind of compared notes and said, well, you know, that works, this thing works not only on paper, but we plotted where the starting point would be, where an agroforestry system would go, where the water channel would go, and it made sense.
Like you walked it and you could see that you would have said something similar if you wouldn't have had that already made design.
Exactly.
Were there surprises, like things that you considered, like, I wouldn't have thought about it, but actually it makes sense, what the algorithm suggested?
There were no surprises, but it was just confirming that the algorithm had learned to do this, to place this design on the landscape accurately. And we were walking around with the local farmers and they said, yeah, how does water behave here? Where traditionally does the rain fall and where does it go? And so just some local knowledge infused with that artificial intelligence really was very exciting. It was a big relief for us that it worked.
Yeah, imagine if it didn't make any sense. They would say, no, water never goes like that.
Yes. So we got back to the car and rehydrated ourselves. And then we said, well, we really have something quite powerful here.
So basically there's key point and the key lines were sort of mapped on the map, or there was a layer on the map, and then you started adding extra layers of where could some ponds be or some other water features, and then you expanded it to agriculture features like agroforestry systems and where does tree make sense, but also which type of tree, like what is the level of detail you managed to get to?
Yeah, so we built up in different layers where the contours of the land are, how key points and key lines work on that digital elevation model.
And just currently the land is, you said it's flat, it's very dry, it rains. When it rains a lot. Are there a lot of trees on the landscape? Or what is the current state or what's the current feature?
It's cultivated, but in straight lines with big erosion valleys cutting through. And so you could see how that production system is placed incorrectly on the landscape. It doesn't work from an ecological point of view. So if we were to change the design of how cultivation worked and how water flows, and it would be regenerative rather than degenerative.
Would it mean to cut down all the current trees and start from scratch, or do you adapt the system to, okay, that one needs to go, or that one, there, we need to plant more there, or...
No trees are ever cut down. And some of the trees in this landscape were very mature mango trees, so you wouldn't want to be cutting any trees down at all.
And even if they're on the wrong spot. Yeah.
Even if the wrong spot, leave them. They were there before us, and they'll be there long after we're gone, I'm sure, but never cut down a tree. It's done its best to be there, so leave it. So our designs would be placed onto the existing tree pattern.
And the algorithm takes that into account because it sees the current features, which are trees and houses and small villages.
Exactly. And trees know what they're doing. So they're obviously doing well there. They found a good place to grow.
So they are in a good spot. They're not in the wrong spot. Yeah.
Exactly. So let's try and use those to help us understand how the landscape works and mimic their growth patterns rather than trying to force it in a direction it doesn't want to go.
And so what's next now, like where are you? We're talking summer 2021. What is the client doing currently or wants to do? Or what are the next steps in implementing some of this or testing?
Let me speak a bit about our partners in Nigeria. It's only about a year ago, actually, that they first contacted us. The Dantata family, a very old family with a great legacy in northern Nigeria. And they work with many hundreds of thousands of small farmers. The Dantata family process a lot of rice and groundnuts and all those soya beans, all those for the Nigerian market and overseas. But they quite correctly thought, as we move forward and climate change begins to really hit these small farmers, not just in Nigeria, but everywhere, it's their business that is under threat, as well as the small farmers' livelihood. So to have some kind of regenerative agriculture program for their entire outgrower schemes is not only the right thing to do, but it's also good for business. So they said, can you help us design the landscape and then work with the farmers to switch them over, to transition them? So it was with Tajuddin's vision and working with our technology that we put those two things together and came up with a big plan for them. And this plan is also being embraced by the UK government and their aid programs, forcing their thinking down, okay, let's use regenerative agriculture as this vehicle for development. And then the more farmers we can get involved in these schemes, that has flow-on effects for the environment and social benefits, a whole raft of benefits. So it was from that discussion and that close relationship with the Dantata family that we said, okay, this is one of our firm footprints overseas and a very interesting environment to work with, where you can really see the results of regenerative agriculture, not just working with the water infrastructure and how that flows in the landscape, but things like cover crops, humic soil additives, and a whole suite of interventions, actually, which put humus back in the soil, organic matter, carbon, of course, and therefore you can really see how the landscape responds quickly. I guess there, if you, like in Australia, you're starting from a very low base, and any carbon and organic matter you can put back in the soil, really see the benefits quite quickly. So that's our work there is ongoing. I go to Nigeria every few months to push it along. And it's the whole regenerative agriculture theme has become embraced by people to such an extent that they didn't have words for regenerative agriculture. So we've had to make some up in Hausa and Fulani languages. So farmers are now, they understand what we're talking about. We're not talking technical things. We're using that regenerative agricultural term in local languages. So again, that helps them adapt and transit to those types of production methods.
And what's the vision for that landscape, or where does the landscape could go to or tends towards? Like it's very hot, as you described, it's very arid, but there's also water and limited time, not necessarily quantity. So where do you see that going to? What does the design, a lot of extra trees, agroforestry systems, different grazing, even vegetables, what do you see that landscape, the potential in 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, it's a mixture of all those things you describe. It's agroforestry systems, it's integrated grazing, it's reintroducing the complexity back into the system, because that then is a big safety net for resilience going into the future. So it has several purposes, regenerative agriculture in that part of the world. It's, of course, for food production, resilient food production as we go into the future, livelihood regeneration as well. It's also useful to stop the Sahara Desert coming further south, like the Great Green Wall project. We're contributing to that and seeing how farming communities with regenerative agriculture can kind of plug a few gaps here and there. It's about also working with farmers that farm around biodiverse areas which are under pressure. So in that part of the world, there are several river valleys, wetland areas that farming inevitably encroaches onto as farmers seek a more productive area. But if we can work with what's called a jurisdictional approach, so we work with all the area, including the biodiverse areas, so those are conserved and regenerated, but also the farming areas are regenerated, so there's less pressure on those very important biodiverse areas. So then we've encapsulated all the area. We're able to increase food production, revenues from that increase, but then it also lines the whole communities up for complementary revenue streams like carbon credits or biodiversity credits. There's a whole raft of these things coming up now, which can only help and lift up. And we're getting a lot of interest from finance providers that deliver climate solutions. So these big projects are of interest because they can pour a lot of climate finance funding into it and in return conserve biodiverse areas, help local farmer livelihoods. It's just a great package we can offer.
And so with the design, I wouldn't say done, but let's say the first design done and even down to the level of what tree species, what's the next step? When is planting beginning or what's the implementation look like? Or do you see, okay, we actually need a few more versions of the software and of the algorithms before we are down to the point where we can say, okay, here we need to plan, so let's go? Or like, what do you see there currently and what are the next steps there?
Yeah, well, ultimately with farming, at some point, somebody's got to go into a field and do something. So in essence, essentially the technological artificial intelligence enabled designs, the easy bit. It's accurately costed, planned, down to the minutest detail. The next step we've got is to continue our technology development, but we're already getting this first project financed. So the design is important. The finance to make it work is important.
And you see the design as a key point to, I wouldn't say convince, but to get especially larger scale projects off the ground, you need to make it, yes, to simulate it, to make it visible what could happen. Because otherwise, we always talk about yeoman and key lines, etc. But for large financial institutions or large investors, that just doesn't convince too much.
No. And the simulation is really important because we're talking about improving things, creating impact, regenerating natural capital. We're making big claims here. So in order to be able to substantiate those claims, we have to be able to measure and monitor and prove with data that we've gone from this level to this level, which is better. And it's really essential to do that. We're not providing a generic model here that, oh, if you try this, something like this might happen. We're actually designing a location-based specific design and then measuring and monitoring that and also monetizing it at the end. So data and measurement throughout that from a financial perspective, from an ecological regeneration perspective, even down to things like if we're claiming that livelihoods are better and more jobs are created, tracking that so people can really convinces people if you can show them the hard numbers that, yeah, we've had some impact here and let's try and do that on another area and another area, and so the whole thing can replicate and expand. And that's where I think the power of our tool really works, because we can say, okay, we've done 10,000 hectares here. If we were to translate that into 1 million hectares, what would that be like?
What would that mean?
Yeah.
And do you see the interest now from the finance world to work on this specific one? Is that the phase where you're in now? Like, okay, how do we actually get into the field and get going, and how do we finance that? Or is it something that's on the side of the client, the farmer and the family, and the person and family, they have for sure connections to the finance world if they're processing at that scale? Like, what's holding you back now to implement the 10,000 hectares?
Well, we're not sort of handing over the design to them and saying, there you go, thanks very much, we're off. No,
here you can order the trees, yeah.
Yes. No, we're involved in the next phase of implementation and actual project development, because if we can stay with the project throughout its inception and getting into a mature phase, what's important for us is to stick with it and, of course, make sure it's delivered correctly, but also to get data from the project itself and feed back into our algorithm so it sharpens up, we can learn from it, and that therefore the designs in other places are more accurate. So for us, it's a long-term engagement. And of course, if you're selling any carbon credits from that project, it's important to be able to measure those every year and report on that. Otherwise, you've got to give all the money back. So that's not what we want to do.
It's quite an essential, also to investors, if people have, I don't know, supported a green bond for, invested in a green bond for large scale landscape regeneration, you want some kind of reporting and some kind of, it's not enough just to have the simulation and to have the nicely rendered simulation where you can wear your VR glasses and see how it might look. It's nice at some point to have the actual growth rate of the trees and to have the rain infiltration rates and things like that to actually back up.
I think it's essential because you've entered into a financial transaction with a buyer. And if I was buying these credits, I'm going, well, what am I actually buying here? Is this a bit of greenwash? I can tell my shareholders, or have I actually bought sequestered carbon or water credit or a biodiversity net grain credit? I want to be able to say, okay, it's gone from here to here. It's actually real. There are the independent measurements. I feel comfortable and excited by my purchase, and I want to buy some more. And that's where we want to set up everybody for.
And from the technology perspective, having made that, I wouldn't say the jump, but definitely the step from singing at the campfire around permaculture or walking the land, walking it personally, and now involving a lot of tech, what do you feel that is still missing to, if anything, on the tech side to get regenerative ag to a regeneration to a landscape level?
For us as a business, it's data and the availability and affordability of data. If we can get access to that, it kind of opens up areas.
And data meaning what the land actually looks like to feed that into the algorithm.
Yeah, it's high resolution stuff. And it's partly available by satellite, but it's expensive. We can partly acquire it through commercial drones who have like a heavy payload and good cameras. And so we can take a lot of data, a lot of photogrammetry images from that. But going forward, if we're to do this at scale and measure things accurately at scale, particularly carbon sequestration or water flows or ecological functioning in general, it's the data, it's the cost of that data, so we can really put it through our algorithms and machine learning tools. So it's not just wild claims we're making. It's actually how the landscape is functioning. And I think that's a very exciting area, not for us, just us to get involved with, but agritech in general, in that we have a whole world to map here and understand better. It's rather like, you know, all the data points that are taken from us on social media to understand our behavior, and it's done very cleverly. But let's try and do that to figure out how a landscape functions, and so we can know if that landscape is in trouble or it's regenerating or degenerating. Let's have all those data points in a landscape so we can come up with a better design. We can embrace those natural systems and then make them work in our favor. We're part of it. We should be part and understanding how that ecosystem works because we are part of it. And the data to understand that really needs to develop a lot more. And we're excited to be part of the sector, you know, just designing a little bit of it. It's very fulfilling.
And you're saying that basically when it comes to soil on a landscape scale, but also soil on a farm scale, there's very little we know how it behaves and how it could behave and how water could move on a landscape, unless you are a landscape whisperer. There's actually, it's an enormous gray area or enormous unknown area where we're moving into to start discussing how to design, as we have done, but in a very destructive way, and landscapes to move on the regenerative continuum, to start making steps forward and to understand water flows, biodiversity flows, animal flows, plant flows, and all of that. And it's, but you're saying we're very, very, very early on that. And there's some satellite data, but not accurate enough. And there's a lot of other data which we actually don't have, and biodiversity data on most of the world, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, after the Second World War, that push to produce more food and narrow down the factors you had to consider to produce food so you could manage them closely, seeds, fertilizer, pesticides, insecticides, machinery. The enterprises which were developed just had 5 or 6 factors to consider and try and push nature out of the way so we can measure how much seed, measure how much fertilizer, and look what's happened. It's been we produced a lot more food, but at what cost? So if we look at it through a different lens, all those natural processes and systems that operate in the landscape, the nitrogen cycle, the carbon cycle, all those soil web systems, you know, biological, chemical, we don't really know a lot about them. And it's going to take more than our lifetimes to find out about them. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't trust them. And so if we encourage those natural systems to come back and use them, I like to think we use them as part of the team, part of the farm management team. We don't understand how they work. But
exactly,
but they
do their job, so who cares? Yeah.
And importantly, from a farm business point of view, they are free and will never fail. So having those guys as part of your team, that's a wonderful thing to have. It's a big safety net, I think. So encouraging them to work continuously, 24/7, without a break, for free, and helping you, why wouldn't you?
And if you could change one thing in the food and agriculture system, you had a magic wand and you have a magic power, what would that be?
I think I'd like to open up people's minds and take the blinkers off a bit.
Which one specifically?
There's not just one. It's just a question of taking the blinkers on, because I think people have fear of change. And it is not just in farming, but in life in general, that fear of change. But what we'd like to do is present to those people who are reluctant to point their farm businesses down the regenerative path, let's have a look. Let's give you some examples of where it's worked. Let's simulate what might happen on your farm so you're more comfortable. And then there's a few stepping stones.
Because then when it's on your farm, I know in a pre-interview you mentioned that you're working in this specific project in Nigeria also on basically with VR glasses to be able to see how a landscape could look like. And then it suddenly, if it's on your land or the land you know and you could see what it potentially is, do you think that's that will open up people's mind to it? Or then it's like, no, that's too radical. Like, we could never work here, even though I saw it at the neighbor or down the line, down the street a lot further. But do you see it on, if it's on their land, is that a potential trigger point?
I think so. And it's one of the trigger points as a farming business that's in trouble gets further and further to the kind of hitting the brick wall. If we can show them this, okay, here's what it would look like. Put the goggles on and see how your farm might look going into the future. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think it's to do as well with succession issues on the farm. As the older generation come towards retirement, they're passing the responsibility on to the sons and daughters. The sons and daughters are going, oh, like, great, but oh my goodness, we're in trouble. We've got to do a turnaround. So enabling them with technology. And I noticed really when I walk around a farm, you know, you do a farm visit and the family usually walks with you, the older generation talking, but the younger generation usually have an iPad or an iPhone in their back pocket. And so, yeah, of course, taking the family unit as a whole, but really focusing the future on that younger generation who don't mind going on and simulating and visualizing and putting the goggles on, and because it's their responsibility for the future. So it's that point of connection with that younger generation that's really making things come alive, not just in Nigeria, but here in the UK where we're based. Again, those family farms who are struggling a bit, looking at these new government schemes coming out, how do we get involved with that? What about technology? It's kind of a very fertile area to explore with them. So that's what it's not what I change. I think that's what is changing at the moment. And we're in a good spot to help out as much as we can.
What would happen if you would be in charge of a relatively large investment fund? So it could have a long investment horizon, doesn't have to be a 10-year or whatever fund, but it has to be invested. Let's say you have $1 billion or £1 billion sterling to be invested. What would you focus on? I'm not saying down to the dollar. I'm curious what your priorities would be if you had this kind of assets under management to put to work.
It's a nice thought to have, isn't it? And hopefully we're heading down.
It's a burden as well. Yeah,
it's a tremendous responsibility. But, you know, I'd think of myself as being in a very fortunate position. Like, like a great artist being commissioned to produce a masterpiece. But that masterpiece is a living, breathing, natural asset or a portfolio of assets that has to perform financially. But also we have to educate and enable the realization that these assets perform in several other ways alongside being financially profitable. Again, that's kind of a more artistic way of describing it. But if we look at that holistic picture, we are getting the most from our farms, from our rural assets. And I think now, certainly some of the large institutional investors we're talking to are widening their thinking. We had to start with describing how a farm would behave as if it were an office block and you know,
real estate, yeah.
Real estate.
Change some light bulbs, put a solar panel on the roof. And
yeah, how much can you rent it out for a square foot? That kind of thing. Well, yeah, you can describe a farm that way to engage, first of all, but then we've been widening out the conversation. And interestingly, some investors we spoke to, they got all that, and we thought, okay, well, we've been speaking about natural capital regeneration and all the different revenue streams you can get on there, and the returns per year are acceptable for their, you know, investors as well. So that was all good. And then, interesting, they've come back to us with actually what they're really interested in. And it's different depending on who you talk to. And one of them said, well, we're really interested in these farm assets, as they call them, providing a vehicle for new entrants into the farming industry. We get all the financial stuff, the natural capital stuff, all that, but it's how do we...
Generation transition.
Yeah.
Could be the sons and daughters, could be completely new people entering, because there are a lot, actually, access to land for many aspiring farmers using regenerative practices is very, very, very difficult, because they often, unless you inherit it, it's very difficult in many places to get your hands on a sufficient scale piece of land to do any farming. Of course, you can rent it, and it's but there's the land access and land ownership piece is a very big one.
And I think these issues aren't new. You know, if you've read Thoreau's book, Walden, I mean, back in the 1850s, these issues were there. It's how do farmers work all their life to pay off the mortgage to own the farm, and then what? We're still there. And so if we can work in this new urgent era of climate change and have the landscape as a potential solution for that, and take the issue of I have to own the farm in order to be able to contribute and have a career. If this farmland can somehow be held in long-term trust and the investors are getting there, you know, they're all happy, but it removes the hurdles.
And the huge cash needs and loan needs and mortgage needs to buy.
And the burden going forward of, gosh, I've got to, how much do I owe this month to pay off? Let's remove that.
Let's focus on the farming.
Let's focus on the farming. Let's focus on the soil. Let's focus on the water. And let the people that are really focused on that financial asset management do that. And we're in the middle trying to help the process, help with the management, help manage that those assets in a profitable and productive way, but also, you know, solve that food production resilience issue as well.
And as a final question, where are you contrarian in the sector, in the regen ag sector? What do you believe to be true about regenerative agriculture and food that others don't? Definitely inspired by the question John Kempf always asks, if you are somewhere contrarian.
Well, you know, there's always a few naysayers in any point in life. I believe regenerative agriculture to be more productive and profitable. It's difficult to prove that sometimes because we don't have farm data on regenerative agriculture farms going back 30 years. We have some excellent examples, though, that are doing very well now. So I believe absolutely that to be true. I also believe that, coming back to the issue of change and farmers and reluctance, nervousness. I also believe that a farmer once said to me, the most difficult thing to change in a farmer is the field between his ears. It's that if we can change mindsets, then everything starts to flow from there. Sometimes these farmers are in deep financial and personal crisis. And so if we can just provide a small light at the end of the tunnel to say, give this a go, it will probably work. But let's go that together. That kind of coming back to those eight ingredients of agriculture, people, they're further down the track, but they're absolutely essential to make it work. So without that, you know, natural systems operate, but the person factor, the people factor in this are critical to have motivated people, understand, enabled by technology, so we can get there quicker and at scale, I think.
I always say last question and it never is, but what is on the roll for, like, after this design, are you working on any other places, exciting designs? I'm imagining quite a few people reached out after you published it on LinkedIn. I will definitely link the article below in the show notes. What is planned for other designs at other places, other circumstances and contexts?
Yeah. We're getting contacted daily from all the way around the world. But our focus for the next few years is in Nigeria and other countries in Africa, doing similar types of projects, large landscapes, but in Africa, smaller individual farmers grouped, aggregated together. We have some really interesting opportunities in Central Asia, where the dynamics are totally different. Massive landscapes, but very small numbers of farmers, and really lots of abandoned land, if you like, or land just left there not being productive. And so that's kind of a blank slate for us to design something that's really, really good and efficient. And of course, back where we're based, back in the UK, this whole...
You're using the design software as well. It works in different climates, let's say, as well. It works in the UK.
Yeah, and that's going back to the importance of data, getting data from the specific location you're working with. So, yeah, Central Asian environments, huge, massive. Northern Nigeria, yes, but small farmers. And back in the UK, it's kind of where we're starting to get a lot of traction is by family farmers who are really, like I said, up against it, need to change direction, but also from institutional clients like water companies who say, how can we engage farmers to solve one of our problems, like nitrate runoff or whatever it is? So those clients are really getting interested. Yeah. So the technology works in all these different places for different people.
As long as the data is good and detailed.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to thank you so much, Jason, for sharing, opening up and this conversation. And I will be checking in. I always say that, but it really will. To follow this piece along and to follow the different projects you're involved in. And of course, the technology that is still being developed and will never be finished.
Thank you very much, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
If you found the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast valuable, there are a few simple ways you can use to support it. Number one, rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. That's the best way for other listeners to find the podcast, and it only takes a few seconds. Number two, share this podcast on social media or email it to your friends and colleagues. Number three, if this podcast has been of value to you and if you have the means, please join my membership community to help grow this platform and allow me to take it further. You can find all the details on gumroad.com/investingregionag or in the description below. Thank you so much and see you at the next podcast.